Please silence all electronic devices.
Voter-owned elections, as opposed to plutocrat-owned elections, which is what we have now in the United States, is a way of ensuring that we actually have democracy, that not just a handful of people get to control the government, because that's increasingly
so the people that you don't like should be...
Yeah,
should
that's
have
definitely
their,
what I'm
well,
saying. Come on.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. What a week. Think about these last few days, if it's possible to do this, through the lens of, like, 2010. We had Mitt Romney vote to remove a sitting Republican president from office. Rush Limbaugh received the Presidential Medal of Honor. And the Iowa caucuses crumbled to the point that the Associated Press said it isn't even going to bother declaring a winner. Indeed, as Mark Twain once wrote, truth is stranger than fiction. Time again for our review of some of what happened in politics this week. The fiasco in Iowa and also campaign fundraising in North Carolina is the primary focus of our conversation. As usual, it's Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray with the Conservative John Locke Foundation. And I did begin our recording by wishing them both a happy Friday.
Yes, indeed.
We're 4 days from the first primary of 2020, that in New Hampshire, but unfortunately, I think it's unfortunate, we must begin with the fiasco that was the Iowa caucuses. Technical breakdowns, uncertainty, and a whole lot of wasted time and money. What does what happened or didn't happen this week in the Hawkeye State potentially mean for North Carolina's primary, now just a few weeks away?
Well, who says we don't need improvements to our election system? I mean, the reality, I continue to be struck by the fact that we have this just hodgepodge of system. I mean, obviously it's not a caucus system. It's a voting system in which people have the, you know, privacy of the ballot and all that stuff in North Carolina. We certainly don't expect the kind of chaos they had in Iowa. But it does, to me, point out the fact that there's a crying need both here and nationally for uniform, high quality standards for, I would say, even publicly produced ballots and systems of voting. We get contractors out of this. We get the chances of hacking out of it. We get the dependence on computer technology out of it as much as we can. Go to paper ballots that can be checked. I mean, that's the direction I think we need to head. And this just reiterates to me that it's just hard to believe in 2020 we still can't get this right.
Well, I think one thing's for sure. Iowa set a new standard for how not to do elections. And the results, I mean, you know, as we speak, I'm not sure even all the results are in yet. So it was...
I talked to a Democratic strategist earlier today who joked that we might have them by the time of the convention in the summer.
Right. So how much difference does this make? But you talk about a confusing system. So I think there's going to be some serious conversation about, do we still do the Iowa caucuses at all? Is there another system to do it? I agree with Rob. I mean, I think the integrity of our election rest largely on, you know, are people's ballots cast appropriately and are they counted? And, how is this done? And, you know, the other thing, to be done in a timely fashion is the other thing with it.
Right.
So, you know, what impact this will have on us for our primary, I don't know that it puts additional pressure, but there's already pressure on our state board of elections and election officials across the state, the different counties, on holding these elections. And I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I am willing to bet that we will not have a situation like there was in Iowa. North Carolina will do it better.
It's worth saying that Iowa's not the only state that's historically had the caucus system or a variation of the caucus system. And there's an argument to be made that there's something special about it, of people being forced to stand up and defend their candidate and gather with their fellow citizens to look each other in the eye. It's a different way of selecting your candidate. It's not an election per se for a high office. It's just a party making use of a technique to pick its candidates. But I think we still can both agree that the way they were doing it wasn't working this week.
But I will mention too that the results that we do have out of Iowa, and we can assume they're somewhat accurate. But I think that, this race has gotten interesting with Bernie Sanders not being the lead. I think a lot of people did really close between he and Pete Buttigieg. So I think there's going to be, I don't know, but I would guess that there would be an increased interest. And so we may be surprised at the voter turnout when we have our primary in May, particularly for the Democratic primary.
Would either of you like to make the case that Iowa should go first or that this is not an antiquated system? There's been a lot written and a lot said this week about the fact that this very small, very white Iowa electorate gets to have such an outsized influence. And you also have New Hampshire and Nevada and South Carolina that all go before Super Tuesday. Would either of you like to sit here and say,
defend it.
Say we ought to keep doing this come 2024.
I've always been thought that the primary system itself, I mean, the very idea that we vote 9 months ahead and then there's this long, it almost feels like it was designed by political junkies to feed, you know, the institution of talk shows like this and talk television. I mean,
bank accounts and consultants.
Yeah, it seems like a wacky way. And then, of course, the reality is, yes, absolutely, Iowa's not a representative state, particularly of the Democratic Party, in that it's, you know, an overwhelmingly white rural state with a very small population, not very diverse. I mean, it's just, it's a strange situation that we probably, I think is probably on its way out. But like a lot of these things, it develops sort of just an institutional momentum of its own. It's difficult to dislodge. And there's a lot of people in Iowa who like going first and like all the attention that it brings, sort of this permanent campaign in their state.
I agree. I think that the state should hold their campaigns exactly like they want to. I mean, you know, that's what the authorization is. The federal government, the federal constitution says we'll have regular elections and leaves it up to the states to conduct those elections in the way that they want to. And if Iowa wants to do this, I think they should continue to do it. I like the way North Carolina does. I agree with Rob. I think these long general elections with the really early primary, just as a political junkie and somebody that likes to learn a lot about the different candidates and hopefully make informed votes, I just like more time to get to know those primary candidates before we have to vote on them. But, you know, again, I think states should conduct their elections the way they want to.
So I can't help but think about what this effect will have. To use a Becky word, whether or not it will have a chilling effect on candidates come 2024. And you just think about the time and the money that goes into Iowa. If there are going to be candidates who eventually go, I don't need to do this. I need to focus on bigger ticket, bigger delegate states down the line, which is exactly what Michael Bloomberg has done in this race. He's spent no time in Iowa. In some ways, it seems like he's truly the winner of the Iowa caucuses because he didn't deal with
That's
this.
That's a good point.
The thing is, if you're a relatively low-financed, under-the-radar candidate, I mean, it all goes back to Jimmy Carter, right? He's the first one who probably really made the Iowa caucuses famous because he had a ground game. He put it in there early. People weren't even sure who this man was, and he won there, and it sort of elevated his candidacy, and that can happen. I mean, I think it's fair to say that Pete Buttigieg would probably not be on as many tongues today had he not done as well as he seems to have done in the Iowa caucuses. So it'll be hard to dislodge it, but I think if, in fact, neither Buttigieg or Sanders wins the nomination, there'll be increasing fuel for the notion that, you know, it's just sort of irrelevant.
When you go to, I mean, somebody's going to be first. And so I think the first state, whether it's Iowa or whether it's North Carolina or whether it's California, is going to get a tremendous amount of tension because as those primary candidates are trying to establish themselves, whoever wins in that first primary election, no matter where it is or what the system is, they have an advantage. Everybody wants to get out in front of the pack. So if it's not Iowa, it will be somebody else.
4 days, New Hampshire.
Yeah.
You want to offer any predictions?
Well, I will say that it's pretty clear to me that the Democratic electorate is actually being very pragmatic this year. They are united on the premise that they want to defeat Donald Trump, that they are horrified, aghast at the notion of this con man inhabiting the White House for another 4 years. And so I actually think they are struggling to find the candidate that they think is the most capable of beating Trump. And I honestly don't think there's, I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders has his reputation. He's a democratic socialist and other people would portray him as being on the left. As a practical matter as to what would happen if any of these individuals was elected president in 2020 and took office next year with what we presume will be a relatively divided Congress, I actually don't think there would be that much difference in the policies that they would implement. I think that realization is starting to dawn on a lot of Democrats. And although, you know, there's obviously passionate supporters of each candidate, I think ultimately there's going to be an effort to find the one, there's going to be a pragmatic effort by Democratic voters to find the person they think that can dislodge Trump.
I think that's probably true, but I think there's tremendous difference between, say, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. I think a lot of people also are looking at what does the candidate look like of, as Rob mentioned, who can beat Trump, but also who's going to have an impact. I think my colleague John Hood wrote a column this week about the devastating impact that a Bernie Sanders candidacy would have on North Carolina Democratic candidates. So I think there's a lot at stake there. I think there's tremendous difference across the big primary field of the Democratic presidential candidates. And it seems to me that in a lot of ways they're sort of fighting for the soul of the Democratic Party, or what is the next step for the Democratic Party, whether you've got the socialist, whether you've got more moderate with Joe Biden, or newcomers like Michael Bloomberg. I think it's a really interesting discussion.
And I'll pull the curtain back here for a second and note that Rob was just shaking his head a little bit to say, oh, there's not that much of a difference between Biden and Sanders. So let's hammer down on that point. I mean, the three, just three of the examples that come to mind for me would be health care, student debt, and the environment. Specifically, a subset of that would be fracking. There are fundamental differences between Biden and Sanders
There are differences, but in terms of what they would actually get enacted if they became president of the United States and working with Congress, who they would appoint as the heads of agencies, so much of the import of what happens when you have a president is who they appoint to run the various agencies, who gets to staff up deputy secretary of this and that in labor and environment and education. I would argue that the difference between the two is actually not that great. I don't think there would be that much difference in who they would appoint, for instance, to the Supreme Court. Sure, Bernie Sanders is a fiery guy. He's had a much more aggressively progressive message for a long time. I'm sure it would be seen as a much more earth-shaking election if Bernie Sanders were elected, just as sort of some would say Trump's election was. Many say that Sanders and Trump, in some respects, are the flip side of each other, that they both have a populist appeal. And indeed, there are some people who, amazingly enough, who have voted for Donald Trump, who have also expressed an interest in voting for Sanders. So that there's that aspect of the political aspect, but in terms of the actual policies that would be implemented in the long run, I would argue not as big a difference as a lot of people would say.
Well, of course, a lot of that would be in the administration that some of these candidates would pick. And I think as we get further along, that might be the question. When we see what the vice presidential pick for the final candidate will be, will tell us a lot. But don't forget, too, it's not just the presidency. It's not just an administration. It's also the Congress that you're working with. So that also brings, and I think we'll see this as we go along. We've already seen Tom Tillis really closely align himself with Donald Trump as these other candidates are fielded and we see them travel across the state, when we see who comes into North Carolina to campaign and which North Carolina politicians or which congressional candidates are on the stage with which of these candidates is going to be very telling as well.
Whatever Democrat gets elected is going to go after the climate crisis. They're going to have a relatively consistent foreign policy that mirrors a lot of what President Obama pursued.
Increased government spending tremendously. All of them have.
Well, we certainly hope so.
And so they do have that.
And I think they all will be doing their best to repeal the giveaways to the wealthy and corporations that Trump has implemented.
Republicans need to pick up 19 seats to have control of the U.S. House. Democrats need to net 4 and the White House to get the U.S. Senate, if I'm doing this correctly off the top of my head. Everything is in play come 2020.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Everything is indeed in play. It is indeed an election year. That means money, money, money. Let's move to the state here, where a new campaign fundraising reports were released this week. Among the notable tallies, the state Democratic Party raised more than double the state Republican Party for the second half of 2019. Democratic Governor Roy Cooper raised about 3 times as much as Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest. He's the anticipated general election opponent of Cooper. As for legislative leaders, Phil Berger and Tim Moore just dwarfed the efforts of their legislative counterparts. Money is not the most important thing in politics, but it does help to buy many of the most important things. A takeaway and or a surprise from this latest batch of campaign finance reports?
First of all, it's very early. You know, I mean, all the candidates are out raising money. You see that a lot. So first of all, it's very early to do this. And Jeff, as you mentioned, you know, the candidate who raises the most money does not always win. And we're seeing that more and more. So I don't know that it's a strong indication. The other thing with this, I thought one point that was kind of interesting, the legislative money that's being raised, the difference in the ways the parties are structured, the Republican leadership in the General Assembly is raising a lot of money. On the other hand, the Democratic Party is raising a lot of money. The Republican Party doesn't raise as much money to give to the legislative candidates. So there's just it's kind of a different structure on that.
And briefly, my understanding of that is that Phil Berger and Tim Moore, leader of the Senate, leader of the House, essentially get to play bankroller with this. They are able to dole out, and obviously with the input of strategists, dole out where this money needs to go, which races are in the most need of resources. It's just a different approach.
The Democrats do the same thing. I just think more of that money comes from the Democratic State Party rather than the legislative leader. So it's just a different sort of org structure, if you will.
And it might be easier to raise money for Phil Berger and Tim Moore because they're in power. Well, I mean, the Democratic
It always is. Well, it was when Mark Bassnight and Jim Blackwood. Yeah, I mean, that of course it is.
The parties that are in power, it's so much easier to raise. You know,
well, that's what, you know, Roy Cooper's raising three times what Forrest is. So the power of the incumbency.
Right. I don't disagree with it at all. I think that's the main story here. It's kind of depressing. I mean, the notion that a couple of men who have worked their way up through the bureaucracy of the legislature and ensconced themselves in power, Phil Berger now is following the Mark Bassnight lead, going to be in power for years and years and years, gets to affect, they have no real race of their own to run, and yet they raise oodles of money that they then dole out to these to pick the people that they want to be in the legislature with them. Those people then in turn have this tremendous obligation to do what they're told when it comes to voting in the legislative session. It's a sad commentary on the way our politics are now being driven by big dollars being funneled through a handful of very powerful, wealthy individuals and groups on both sides of the aisle. And it's just a sad commentary, I would say. I will say that in terms of the 2020 election, though, there is a level of passion that's being brought to this election that is going, I think, to make a difference, that where money will be less important in a lot of instances, because particularly with people who are opposed to Donald Trump, they are going to be incredibly motivated. And Trump himself has a core of very devoted followers. I mean, it's a remarkable state of affairs when nearly half the country thinks that the President of the United States, including a very prominent member of his own party, should be removed from office, and yet he's not, you know, he has a very good chance of re-election.
Well, I mean, there's nothing new to see here. I mean, Democrats raise money to get Democrats elected. Republicans raise money to get Republicans elected. I mean, that's what this whole thing is all about. I do agree with Rob that I'm not sure. I think we may see a different kind of influence in this election where the biggest money raiser is not necessarily the one who wins the race. I'm going to be really interested to see the additional impact of social media over this election and, you know, the influence that has. I thought it was interesting in one of the recent debates between the three governors, Hunt, Martin, and McCrory. It was a couple of weeks ago in Charlotte. One of the things that really struck out to me that Governor Martin observed was that, you know, part of the political problem has to do with gerrymandering and part of the division has to do with gerrymandering, but a big part of it has to do with social media. And I thought that was a really interesting observation. And so the more that we depend on social media to get our news, to process our news, and candidates use social media, which is a much less expensive way to get their message out, right. I think we may see greater influence of social media than just dollars.
Particularly if there are Russian hackers out there literally putting totally fake and phony news on Facebook to drive people to
Well, that's
Donald
why,
Trump.
You know, we all have a responsibility to be informed voters, and that's why I think our conversations on Thursday are important.
I agree with
Thank you,
but
Jeff.
You're welcome, and thank you both. It's getting awfully hard sometimes to sort through.
I mean, they can make a phony story look
from
incredibly
all
real on Facebook.
And
you know that the Russians
did
that in 2016.
That's from all sides. But one thing that I do, you know, want to put out, and, you know, we'll also see spending for independent expenditures, which is kind of a whole different dynamic with this.
That's the so-called dark money.
Yeah,
right,
that's
and there will be money from both sides. And Jeff, I think you did an interview with Cal Cunningham this week about, you know, that dark money question. And then a lot of money coming in, we're understanding, in the Roy Cooper race. They'll be coming from out of state, from other places. So that's the other factor when you're talking about money and where it's coming from.
Should note, we just had the 10th anniversary of the Citizens United decision, which basically unleashed this tidal wave of dark money in our nation. And it's, again, I think it's a sad commentary on our politics that we now have a tiny fragment of the electorate through corporate money and the money of an incredibly narrow band of incredibly wealthy people spending a vast proportion of the money that gets spent on our elections in this country. I think that's not how democracy works best.
Two quick follow-ups. Vote Vets, this outside group, has propped up or helped the Cunningham for Senate campaign with multiple millions of dollars, and you know, I had a colleague remark to me recently they feel like they're seeing Cal Cunningham in their sleep because there's so many Cal Cunningham ads that are running right now. One of the things that has struck me as a bit ironic about Cunningham is that he is
the beneficiary of this dark money. At the same time, he would like to reverse Citizens United, so he says. He would like to offer a proposed amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So it'll be interesting to see if this is just a campaign issue or if this is something that really has traction going forward, depending on who's in office in 2021.
Well, I think you just have to be really careful about this, because basically what you're talking about, or essentially what you're talking about, are First Amendment rights, the freedom
of speech.
That's the
debate, right. Do corporations have personhood?
Corporations are people.
That is what the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled.
Yes. Yeah.
I would obviously disagree with that.
But I think we need to be really careful with this and you know, protect people's privacy. And, you know, again, it comes down to a freedom of speech issue.
Yeah, well, I would say it comes down to a freedom of democracy issue, that our democracy has been perverted and purchased essentially by a handful of plutocrats in this country.
So who decides who gets to speak and who doesn't? And whose speech is backed by big money and isn't? I mean, who makes that decision?
There are myriad ways that we can set reasonable limits on the amount that an individual can contribute to a campaign.
Why would you do that?
Why would I do that?
Because why would you put a cap or limit on, and who gets to make that decision?
Well, all of us do. It's what democracies do. The idea of having voter-owned elections as opposed to plutocrat-owned elections, which is what we have now in the United States, is a way of ensuring that we actually have democracy, that not just a handful of people get to control the government, because that's increasingly
what we're going
to. So the
people that you don't like should be
yeah,
should
that's
have
definitely
their,
what I'm
well,
saying. Come on.
Rob? I'm not speaking for Rob. Rob doesn't want anybody to benefit. He doesn't want Cal Cunningham to get $3.5 million and outside.
But he doesn't
money,
want
just as he doesn't want Phil Berger to get $3.5 million and outside. He doesn't want it.
Why does Rob get to make that decision?
He clearly does not get to make that decision.
That's what democratic government ought to be about. We ought to have a system in which the voters actually get to own the elections rather than a handful of very super rich people. Because, I mean, who's kidding who? We've got Michael Bloomberg
now. We all have a right to vote.
Michael Bloomberg
Those are two different things. We do all have a right to vote.
Yes. Who owns the elections?
Literally buy the presidency. I mean, he is trying to literally. Now, I may agree with Bloomberg on a lot more issues than Donald Trump. I may think that the country would be better off if Michael Bloomberg is president. But I don't see how anybody can reasonably argue that would be a good way for our government, for our elections to be funded, for one person who's worth $56 billion
in what
to
way
literally
does he
buy
the
election.
How is he going to buy the election?
Well, if he spends five times more than it's ever been spent in total on the presidential election just on himself, that's a remarkable tectonic shift in our politics. And that
he's getting his message out.
Well, you could say that. You certainly is.
I can tell you, there's no amount of money that he could buy my vote. I mean, Rob, could Donald Trump buy your vote?
Becky, I mean, come on, be realistic.
I am being realistic.
We all know that spending vast amounts of money on an election makes a huge difference.
It all comes down to voters.
You guys aren't swing voters, for the record. Let me ask you this follow-up to try to move it forward a little bit. We do have limits on how much campaign contributions Mrs. Smith or Mr. Jones could make to Phil Berger or Roy Cooper.
And somehow democracy continues.
Do you think those should go away? We have limits presently in the state. It's $5,500 in an election cycle.
Right.
Is that an infringement upon the First Amendment?
If I were designing the system, yes, I would have no limits. Now, I would have 100% transparency and immediate reporting so that at any point you could check on a candidate and see where their money, who was contributing and how much they were contributing to individual campaigns like we have now.
And you trust government to do that efficiently? Have that reporting system? That'd be a big government operation. I'm just picking on you as a small government person. I could see a lot of problems with the reporting system that's supposed to work quickly, were it to be
why
run
not?
By the government.
I mean, you know.
Oh, I love the idea.
Let me tell you, when I charge something on my credit card at the grocery store, by the time I get home, it is posted on my bank account. So why can't we have that same kind of reporting with campaign contributions?
I'm merely offering the possibility of a private report.
I just say free speech ought to be more open rather than more limited.
Well, as a person who spent a lot of his life as a civil liberties lawyer, I agree that free speech is incredibly important. But I think there's a distinction between a corporation spending money on buying an election and the First Amendment.
Last one, maybe also a throwaway, but we had the Iowa caucuses, I guess, on Monday. We had the State of the Union on Tuesday. We had the impeachment trial vote on Wednesday. Do you recall a week like this one ever in politics.
Not. No, of course
right?
not. Because
this is crazy.
We know for a fact that one thing happened this week that has never happened in the history of the Republic, and that is that a very courageous individual voted to convict a president of his own party, and that has never happened in the United States Senate in the three impeachment trials we've had. And to top it off, that individual was the Republican presidential nominee just 8 years ago. It was an amazing speech. I urge everybody who hasn't read it or watched it to watch Romney's speech. And my colleague Billy Ball wrote a great commentary this week that North Carolina would have done well to have a Mitt Romney, and unfortunately got a Richard Burr and Tom Tillis.
After this week and many of the weeks that we've observed at the General Assembly, I am not about to say this is the most or worst it could ever be, because there's always something right around the corner.
I was looking back, not forward. Perhaps I should. Becky Graves, Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekends.
Okay.
Thanks,
see
you,
guys.
You too.
Politics Podcast dropping twice a week right now. You can hear from Becky and Rob Friday afternoons, and then earlier in the week, catch a conversation with a newsmaker in North Carolina political circles. Coming up next week, it's a conversation with Morgan Jackson, longtime Democratic strategist. You can subscribe to the podcast, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and anywhere. I hope that you get that on-demand programming. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff. Enjoy your weekend. We'll talk to you again soon.